to the second case this morning, Tamburo v. Dorton.
Good morning, Your Honours. My name is Ian Branson, and may it please the Court. This action arises from the actions of three United States citizens and two foreign citizens. One is a foreign corporation and one is an individual. I apologize, earlier in the brief, a couple of times it seemed to sneak through that there were actually four United States citizens and one foreign corporation. Apologies to the late Mr. Dworkin, who Canada obviously has not yet been taken over by the United States. The individuals and the corporation used the internet to defame and attempt to ruin John Tamburo and his predecessor business in the context of a dispute over ownership of the contents of online dog pedigree databases. None of the defendants is a citizen of the United States, of Illinois, and obviously that's the reason we're before you on this grant of motion for to dismiss for lack of personal jurisdiction. The operative amended complaint includes various counts. The ones that are important for our purposes today are libel, tortious interference, conspiracy, a declaratory judgment action count, and federal antitrust. Obviously, I can't go over through everything in the brief and don't intend to. There are just a couple of areas I'd like to concentrate. The first area, which I think is controlling in this this entire issue, is the intent to affect an Illinois interest. We readily concede that that almost all of the actions that usually take place as far as personal jurisdiction analysis is concerned took place outside the United States, except for the final action in the two tort cases or the two tort causes of action, which very clearly took place within Illinois. The Seventh Circuit case of Janmark versus Reedy, as far as we're concerned, is controlling here. As that case said, after Calder, the state in which the victim of a tort suffers injury may entertain a suit against the tortfeasor.
That's an overbroad reading of Calder, isn't it?
It may be an overbroad reading of Calder, but I think it's an accurate reading of Janmark versus Reedy.
Oh, yeah. I don't disagree with you on that, but it's certainly an overbroad reading of Calder, and
but
perhaps ought to be explained.
Well, it certainly does give the opportunity for the final action in the tort count to take place in this state. And
what final action are you referring to? I thought this is all, the whole tort here is a cyber tort. It's all on the internet.
Yes, but there is an intent to influence and the Illinois interest, Your
so
Honor,
you just,
in that.
By final action, you're just saying that the injury occurred here because this is where your client is located and
this
where
is where he suffered
the pecuniary loss.
This is where he suffered the economic harm, yes, Your Honor.
You're not suggesting there's something more to this than use of the internet?
No, Your Honor. Well, use of emails, yes, Your Honor, which is, I guess, technically a little different. But and Janmark v. Reedy also says that if you can satisfy that particular standard, you're satisfying the minimum contacts requirement.
Well, the question, therefore, again, is that an appropriate statement of the Calder holding? Because we have other cases that are in contradiction to that. So we've got something of an intra-circuit conflict here, and we're also more or less on our own and out of step with other circuits' interpretation of Calder.
I believe it is an accurate version of the Calder and analysis of the Calder decision, Your Honor. And I believe that this is the one thing that we really have to depend on in this case as far as a clear showing of the jurisdiction is concerned, Your Honor. As for according to in Janmark versus Reedy, there is even language which applies directly to this case, which is that inducing customers of an Illinois firm to drop their orders can be a tort in Illinois. And so therefore, I think once you have the tort, and then I'd like to maintain it as a consistent reading of Calder, you have the due process satisfied, Your Honor. I believe then you can move ahead and say that these defendants should be amenable to the exercise of personal jurisdiction in this state.
Let's talk about Calder then. The Calder case effectively said that the Florida defendants, National Enquirer, the editor and the writer from National Enquirer, both based in Florida, had effectuated an entry of sorts into California when they published the story defaming, or allegedly defaming, Shirley Jones. And when they did that based on sourcing the story in California. All of the sources for the story were in California. California was had the largest circulation of the National Enquirer nationwide. And both defendants knew of the plaintiff's entertainment career in California, and that was its location, and that's where she would suffer the harm, so that they essentially intentionally directed their tort at the state of California, at the plaintiff in the state of California, and essentially therefore effectuated a form of entry into California that made it fair to subject them to personal jurisdiction there under the long-arm statute. And here we have, at best, again, a cyber entry. And how is it that that's sufficient to satisfy the standard?
Well, it's a cyber entry, Your Honor, and it is perhaps not as egregious in the case as in the case of California. But the defendant still made serious efforts to ensure that it wasn't just a general cyber defamation, that it was aimed specifically at the business of my client and my clients who live in Illinois. And they did this not only by the defamations themselves that took place on the message board or the list. They did this by sending emails, and also on their own specific private websites gave the details of my client in terms of his address, telephone, fax, email address. This was very clear that this was an attempt to go after an Illinois citizen. And it being the case, maybe we can't show the same degree of harm that you would if it was a famous actor out in California, but I think you can show that this was a very specific intent aimed at my client in Illinois. It's more than just posting something on the internet. And the problem we have, Your Honor, is that we can stretch as far as saying that the defendants intended to affect the Illinois interests, although Your Honor may not agree with that particular statement. But what the district court did was to somehow add the issue of general jurisdiction to the specific jurisdiction. The district court said you need not only the attempt to affect an Illinois interest, but you also need to establish a nexus between the tortious acts and a commercial transaction between the defendant and the Illinois citizens. I don't believe that in a lot of tort cases that are outside a corporate or a company context, you're going to have that kind of causal nexus. And if you don't have that causal nexus, then I assume you don't have jurisdiction there. And the overriding problem with this case is that nobody anywhere really wants to have personal jurisdiction over this case. What could happen, in a sense, is that you could have a defamation which is spread far and wide over the internet and nowhere to hold the defendants accountable.
Well, you could. You just have to sue them all individually in their home states.
But that's not practical for a small business or an individual, Ron.
It's possible to do it.
Theoretically, you could. Yes, Your Honor, you're quite right. Let me talk very briefly about the conspiracy It's our position that there's a carefully orchestrated campaign to destroy the business of our clients. As Textor said, and this is talking about conspiracy jurisdiction, a plaintiff must allege an actionable conspiracy and a substantial act in furtherance of the conspiracy performed in the forum state, which is Illinois. But the claim does not have to be a well-defined claim. It needs to be a prima facie claim, which is sufficient, if you show the parties, the general purpose, and the approximate date of the conspiracy. As soon as you can get one person or one corporation amenable to the exercise of personal jurisdiction in this state, which we believe we have through several different jurisdictional arguments that I'm obviously not going to get to today, you can bring in the rest of the defendants as long as you show a conspiracy. And I would assert that we have the conspiratorial jurisdiction or conspiracy jurisdiction stated in different parts of our brief, Your Honor. And to save myself a little time for rebuttal, I'm going to stop here, and I thank Your Honors very much for your attention.
Thank you, Mr. Brinson. Mr. Brinson, would you counsel take that?
May I proceed? Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court. I'm Charles Lima, Jr., and I represent the defendants' appellees. Our position is quite clear in that the district court properly dismissed the Sixth Amendment complaint on the basis of lack of personal jurisdiction, and the trial court also correctly denied the plaintiff's motion to transfer. In both instances, we ask that this court affirm the district court's rulings. Of course, I incorporate the arguments in our brief and the record below, but here I'll only address a couple of issues. In particular, I'd like to address the effects test, but before getting to the effects test and the plaintiff's arguments with respect to it, I'd like to take a step back and review the core elements of jurisdictional analysis. The exercise of personal jurisdiction, whatever test is used to determine contacts, must also comport with federal due process. You must have the minimum contacts with the forum state such that maintaining the suit does not offend the traditional notions of fair play and substantial justice. And that fair play and substantial justice in any analysis as a core concept cannot be forgotten. In fact, it's that core element that must guide the actual specific analysis. And that lie at a determination of the contacts with any particular forum does not by itself end the analysis. Rather, if and when the minimum contacts are established, which we contend do not arise here, the contacts then need to be considered in light of other factors to determine whether or not the assertion would comport with fair play and substantial justice. Here, with this in mind, even if the minimum contacts exist, which they don't, exercising personal jurisdiction over the defendants would not comport with due process, fair play, and substantial justice. The plaintiff's counsel, or the plaintiff's appellant's counsel, briefly summarized their view of the facts. But what's important to remember here is that the defendants, in making their statements online, responded to a unilateral act by the plaintiffs. The plaintiffs used the spider robot program to go out through the internet, pull facts from the database defendants' websites, put that into the plaintiff's appellant's commercial product, and sell it. In response, once the defendants, the four database defendants, the three here and the one in Canada, once they learned of that, that's what prompted them to respond to the plaintiff's appellant's unilateral actions and what they perceived to be wrongful conduct. The determination of whether the conduct by the plaintiffs was wrongful or not is not at issue here. Turning specifically to the effects test, the plaintiffs are clearly incorrect. In interpreting Calder and the effects test, there have been three interpretations. One is that mere knowledge of the fact that a particular party, in this case the plaintiff's appellants, happened to be in Illinois would suffice, and that seems close to what the plaintiffs are arguing. They're arguing that mere knowledge by some of the defendants of their location suffices under Calder and Janmark.
Well, we've really got more than that here, though. Website postings that are the subject of the defamation claim here, the tort claims, invited and encouraged any readers of the websites to, first of all, to complain about the conduct, but also then invited any readers of the website to complain to the plaintiff directly and supplied his address, his email, his phone number, his fax, all of which are in Illinois. So invited readers to join a campaign of harassment, essentially, in Illinois.
That's a very good point, and I'd like to address that in two ways. First of all, there is no harassment claim in the complaint. So arguably, if there was a harassment claim directly attacking the fact that the defendants said, you know, the plaintiffs have our product, they're using it, we want you to send a letter requesting that they stop using it, which in my mind there's no tort, and that's certainly not tortious interference with business. It's merely saying, send a letter, please ask them to stop. But there's no claim or harassment here. So the actual request that they send a letter to the plaintiff, while arguably it identifies their knowledge of where the plaintiffs happen to be, it's not going toward any of the claims that are actually in the complaint. But even if it did show some intent directed at Illinois, the second interpretation of Calder, which is more in line with, I guess, what the plaintiffs contend Janmark says, is that there's an intentional tort. All that the plaintiffs have to argue is that there is an intentional tort directed at a particular jurisdiction. And we would contend that that analysis of Janmark and Calder is not correct. As Your Honor pointed out, there's a big difference between Calder and the situation here. Calder, the California was particularly targeted, similarly to Indianapolis Colts. In that case, the Indianapolis Colts happened to be in Indiana. That's where the team was. That's where the team had its perhaps arguably most popularity. So that's why we believe one of the reasons that the court found that it was more pressing to have jurisdiction there. But going back to the intentional direction of a tort, we contend that that's not Janmark and that's not Calder. Now, Janmark can be read to say that, but I think that the plaintiffs actually read Janmark a bit too strictly. Janmark itself identified that there were particular instances where there may not be any conduct that occurs in a particular jurisdiction and jurisdiction or in a particular forum, and jurisdiction would not be there. The court used the example of one party sending, you know, a shipment of freight to New Jersey and the other party throwing the shipment of freight into the ocean. That may affect the financial circumstances of the plaintiff in its home forum, but that's only affecting the bank accounts and the economic interests. It's not enough to bring it back to jurisdiction in the home forum. So I would argue that Janmark says that the home forum may entertain jurisdiction. It doesn't say that it shall or that it always will. And in any case, such an interpretation where all that's required is just an intentional tort being alleged by the plaintiffs has been criticized. Such a broad sweep, as it's been criticized, as such a broad sweep failing to accommodate Calder's emphasis on the fact that the forum must be the focal point of the harm and that the defendant must expressly aim the tortious activity at the forum. And again, going back to providing his name and address, it shows certainly that there was knowledge that some of the defendants, not all of them, used that information, that some of the defendants knew where the plaintiffs were. And it also shows in the particular quote that the plaintiffs use in their reply brief that they did ask that people send a letter and say, stop using the data. But that's all it shows. It certainly does not show that tortious activity was directed at the forum, because there's nothing tortious about that, or at least there's nothing in the complaint related to harassment. Additionally, such an interpretation relies solely on the geographical locus of the harm caused. In doing so, it fails to pay necessary attention to the defendant's knowledge and intent in committing the tortious activity. And as I argue, We do not believe that Janmark holds this or follows this strict interpretation, but even if it recognizes that situation in limited circumstances, that economic harm in the forum is sufficient, or an intentional tort, the allegation of an intentional tort is sufficient, we contend that in these facts, where there are only cyber torts or statements online and through email, that's not applicable. And again, Janmark is also distinguishable. Janmark had commercial entities. There was a competitive history between the parties where one party was trying to essentially create somewhat of a cartel. The defendant, Janmark, I believe it was, feigned off or held off the cartel invitation. And when that occurred, the other party sent threats of litigation to Janmark's customers. So there was a lot of history and a relationship between the parties already. What we'd argue that the interpretation that this court should adopt with respect to the effects test is the interpretation that's been adopted by almost every other circuit. And that is that essentially that there has to be something more than an intentional tort. Something more than an intentional tort is required. And that is consistent with other Seventh Circuit jurisprudence as well as Supreme Court jurisprudence. In Burger King, the court held foreseeability of causing injury in another state is not a sufficient benchmark for exercising personal jurisdiction. Worldwide Volkswagen, the foreseeability that is critical to a due process analysis is that the defendant's conduct in connection with the forum state are such that he should reasonably anticipate being hailed into court there. And this court in Wallace, I think, made absolutely clear in interpreting Calder, we do not believe that the Supreme Court in Calder was saying that any plaintiff may hail any defendant into court in the plaintiff's home state where the defendant has no contacts merely by asserting that the defendant has committed an intentional tort against the plaintiff. That is what the plaintiffs here are arguing, and that's what Wallace, Supreme Court jurisprudence, and nearly all of the other circuits hold as insufficient. Indeed, we must remember that the effects test is just another way of establishing the defendant's relevant conducts. The defendant must still purposely avail himself of the privilege of conducting activities within the forum state and invoking the benefits and the protections of its laws. Most courts agree, again, under the Calder's effects test, that merely asserting that a defendant knew or should have known that his intentional acts would cause harm in the forum state is not enough. Jurisdiction under Calder requires more than a finding that the harm caused by the defendant's intentional tort is primarily felt within the forum. And that's what the plaintiffs are arguing and even acknowledge here today, is that the torts that they're complaining about were made on the Internet, made through email and websites, and that they felt the economic harm in Illinois. And that's simply not enough.
Now, what about this alternative basis of personal jurisdiction against the foreign defendants under Rule 4K2?
It's a very good question, Your Honor. And we would contend that 4K2 would not be applicable. It would obviously only apply to Mr. Dworkin or his estate in Canada and Wild Systems in Australia. And 4K2 does hold that where there's not a single other state that a defendant may be hailed into, that they can be brought into the United States. And we'd argue, though, that they have to have sufficient contacts with the United States to be able to do that. And those sufficient contacts are not here. But even if Rule 4K2 did allow the argument, as the plaintiffs have made, that the defendants have not specifically identified another state, which we acknowledge they have not identified a particular other state. Going back to the due process, still bringing somebody here to Illinois must comport with due process. We'd argue that Rule 4K2 is a means of showing that there may be contacts or a means of bringing someone in through contacts, but it still has to comport with due process and the traditional notions of fair play and substantial justice. In this case, that's just not the case. I mean, the worst that Wild Systems did was have a particular form that some of the other defendants communicated in. And while we're not arguing that here today, Section 230 of the Communications Decency Act would provide him immunity or provide it immunity. The only way that the plaintiffs are arguing that Wild Systems really can come in is on the conspiracy theory of jurisdiction, which we argue is just, even if it is recognized in the Seventh Circuit, which we'd argue that it's not, it's just simply not applicable here. As the court realized below, they have to show conspiracy. There's no evidence of conspiracy. There's no illegal conduct. And the agreement, assuming that there was an agreement between the parties, as the lower court held, was not anything that's actionable.
Well, for a conspiracy to be actionable, too, there has to be an allegation of an overt act committed in the jurisdiction.
That's correct, Your Honor.
In the forum, which is not alleged here, as I understand the amendment complaint.
Sorry to interrupt. That's correct. I would completely agree with you. If the court doesn't have any more questions, I'd just like to conclude by saying that we ask the court to affirm lower court's ruling with respect to dismissing the Sixth Amendment complaint as well as denying the plaintiff's motion to transfer.
Thank you, Mr. Wood.
Thank you.
Brinson, how much time does Mr. Brinson have? You have 4 minutes, Mr. Brinson.
Yeah. I'm interested to hear the response on Jan Merck versus Reedy, but by opposing counsel, there was nothing of this in his brief at all, and so it's somewhat new to me. I think we've gone through that sufficiently. What I do want to make just a couple of points about the egregious acts, because I think the impression is given that this was a harassment case, that there was nothing in it at all. It was just a couple of people saying, well, you really shouldn't do this kind of thing, and there's more than that. This is libel that went across the internet. We don't know how far. We don't know how wide. We do have some indication of the people that got and joined in with this information. The libel was particularly malicious to people that have been brought up dealing with computers. The minute you start talking about the theft of information, and incidentally, there is nothing wrong whatsoever about the conduct of my client, and that's a red herring here. But also when you're talking about hacking is one of those terms that is very pejorative, and when your customers hear far and wide that there's a whole group out there that says you've been stealing information, hacking, doing this kind of stuff, obviously it's harmful. This is not just harassment. The second thing is, as far as Rule 4K2 is concerned, I think opposing counsel said that there were not any substantial contacts between Wild and this and the United States. In actual fact, Wild, they have admitted that 38.7% of their total sales prior to the date of the complaint were made with people in the United States.
You need a federal claim, though. And I know that you've asserted an antitrust claim, but it's not sufficiently pleaded in the amended complaint, and so can't sustain jurisdiction under 4K2. What other federal claims have you got?
Well, the other claim we have directly is a declaratory judgment.
But that's not an independent basis for jurisdiction. You need a federal claim that you're seeking a declaration about, a federal claim of right. What other federal rights are at issue that you want declared in your favor?
I'm not sure there are any other federal claims there, Your Honor. We're just using this as a method to try to get jurisdiction over.
You do need a federal claim, so that wouldn't sustain your 4K2 jurisdictional argument.
Okay. Seeing I didn't get to any of the other subjects in the opening part of my presentation, obviously I would refer Your Honors to my brief for those, and we would ask to have our day in court with personal jurisdiction, Your Honor. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Brinson. Thanks to both counsel. The case will be taken under advisement.